Death Defied out of Edmonton, run by a fellow from 3rd Battalion Patricias, a free military free fall reconnaissance guy. And he runs that with a couple of his civvy buddies, and it's all motorcycle type themed. Same thing with Mad Hatter, motorcycle themed and adventure and all that good stuff. And they support a lot of good causes, and they printed our shirts for Operation Pegasus this year. So yeah, it was good.
Super cool. And for someone that loves bikes such as Harleys,
Yep.
works perfectly, doesn't it?
Oh, it's excellent.
Yeah. Have you always been someone that's loved Harleys, or is it all bikes such as Indian and
I loved all bikes. I started off on a super bike.
okay.
And then when I rode that for 5 years, then started a family, got rid of it. And I got back into, and I hated Harleys in the past. I just, their bikes are works of art, and I've always loved bikes, and I've especially Ducati. And then when I got back into biking, I finally saw some Harleys I actually liked, and they were cheaper than Ducatis, so I went Harley route because it was cheaper, and no one really ever says that.
Did you purchase your bike new?
I bought my first Harley new, and I love bobbers. I love minimal. That's my sniper thing, and all flat black. I don't like shiny. And then I did some long rides, and I was like, okay, this is too hard on the body. So I went with what they call the street glide. Some people make fun of it, called the grandpa glide. I have it all blacked out, all done up with military shit and custom logos and engravings, and it's just pure matte black. And I put a Dyna style seat on it, so it looks, and extended bag, so it looks awesome. It doesn't look like a grandpa glide at all. It looks like a sporty, badass motorcycle. Love it.
I love those Street Fighter bikes as well.
Oh, amazing.
All
Yeah.
blacked
And rat
out and
bikes and
cafe
any.
racers.
Yeah. Oh, all bikes are, to me, are gorgeous and art. Just like sailboats. Sailboats are beautiful.
Oh, yes. Yeah. What about planes for you?
Planes? I love aviation. I love all aviation. Everything.
Cessnas.
Oh, I love a Cessna. I was just teaching a basic parachute course this weekend, and a couple of the young fellows, they're like, "Oh my God, this thing is small." I'm like, "You know what? I've jumped big, massive, big military aircraft, every kind of helicopter, but I love jumping out of a small Cessna. It's just so intimate. You just feel everything. I love it. It's really your basis for skydiving.
When you're skydiving, do you have to get everything prepared on the ground, like gear on, and then you're up on the in the plane or the helicopter?
Yeah, absolutely. So, do you scuba dive? So it's just like scuba, right? Plan the dive, dive the plan. And for that minute of free fall, you have all that planning, preparation. That's everything I love about it, right? Is what are we going to do? What are we going to achieve on this? Because it is a fast sport, you have to achieve all these goals within the 1 minute. So the prep time, getting your kit organized, gear checks, then working with your teammates, doing what we call a dirt dive, your practice on the ground, and that's practicing in the aircraft mock-up on how you're going to exit, how you're going to be positioned, how the count is going to go. You're looking for your tempo. And then when you're practicing your free fall maneuvers, what we do is we get on these creepers. So it's just like a car creeper that goes underneath the car, except it's shaped like our bodies in free fall. And we sit on that, and then we move around on the creeper pad and practice our in air maneuvers. Then we have to discuss what are we going to do once the canopy is open? What's our flight plan? Are we linking up? Are we going to fly side by side? What are we going to do? And then we set our flight pattern and then come in for our landing, because there's a certain way. It's just like landing an aircraft. We always do a downwind leg, do a base leg, and then on final, you're landing into the wind.
Right. Has there ever been moments where you, when jumping off, it's probably not the safest time to do it?
What do you mean?
Like jumping out of a airplane and it's a dangerous situation where the winds are too strong or
No. Well, see,
conditions.
you have wind wind speeds that you cannot jump at. So obviously when you're planning that dive, we have wind direction and wind speed print out for every 1,000 feet to where our drop altitude is. So we understand where we're going to release in order to free fall drift in the sky, along with once where your canopy opens, but you always want to be upwind in order to land onto your target. Cause unlike an aircraft, we don't have forward thrust. So we must open up a upwind above our landing target. Has the winds ever changed to too fast once you've released from the aircraft? For sure, because we can't control everything. And particularly in military jumping, we do have all those restrictions as well, because if you get hurt, you can't fight. And quite a few times we have jumped over winds in the military just because mission first. And then, you know, what's the risk reward? In the Arctic, we've jumped in crazy winds, but we're landing on a lake. So there's no obstacles within that lake.
Interesting. Huh. And when you jump out of an airplane, is it always best to jump forward rather than backwards? Because I've seen both, you know, is that just preference?
Awesome question. So we have a couple of ways that we jump. So depending on, again, aircraft. So obviously, if we're jumping Cessna and we're doing recreational jumping, there's two methods. You can hang onto the strut and you let go with your chest exposed to the forward speed, or you can dive out for fun. So likewise, if we take it to a military concept, if we're doing our normal paratrooper stuff where we're static line, we're hooked into the aircraft, we jump out the door and then the wind turns your back. You're in a jab position. You're kind of picture standing up and then bending 90 degrees. That's how you go out the door on normal paratrooper duties at 1,000 feet, 800 to 1,000 feet. Don't forget, you have your rucksack on, rifle, snowshoes. The rifle and snowshoes are tucked under your arm. And then if you're in reconnaissance platoon or snipers, we're mostly all free fallers, military free fall. Again, you're free falling with your rucksack, but we're jumping out of the back of a ramp of a big aircraft. So yeah, you can do two ways. And most of the time we'll dive out or what we call poise. You can turn your back to the sky facing forward of the aircraft and jump out and again, expose your chest and your body to the relative wind and then come down that way.
How many jumps have you done?
Well, I'm over, quite honestly, I'm way over 600, probably close to 7, but I've only got about 500 recorded. Because when you're a young paratrooper and you're jumping all the time, you kind of like, this will never end, right? Typical young guy attitude. And when I was on the parachute team, the Skyhawks, I didn't record half those jumps, man. So yeah, wow. I've got about 150, 200 jumps not logged, which doesn't work well when you leave the army and you're going and transferring back into the civilian world of skydiving. It's like, well, I'm starting over again. Fortunately, I had a lot of the prominent jumps done. At the time in 1990, I was able to participate in a military world record for canopy relative work, where we were under canopy and we stack our parachutes onto each other. And we did a 13-way. So we had 13 of us suspended. And canopy relative work, which is called crew, CRW, is quite dangerous because you can get wrapped up, lose wind, and then a parachute can wrap around, usually in the middle of the stack. And in 1990, it was fairly new, especially very new to military demonstration team. So that was kind of a cool feat. So luckily that was recorded. So funny story, I was down in Eloy, Arizona with my son, and now my son became my skydive coach. And he used to come watch me jump all the time. And I only had my A license, which is your first level. But I'm a military demonstration parachutist, but there's no civilian equivalent. So I go down there and there's only certain things that I'm limited to now. And they look at my book and they ask for my other experience and they go, well, you're a C license. So here, write the test. And I came out of there with my C license from the United States Parachute Association. So that was good.
Is there still fear in jumping every time? for you?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what keeps the checks and balances and keeps you proficient and stops you from being complacent. You know, when you read the casualty reports every year, USPA, United States Parachute Association, will publish that once a year. And you see fatalities and major injuries report, which have been at the slowest point. The last 2 years have been the lowest injury point. Skydiving is very, very, very safe. And where the injuries come is guys on like their first like 0 to 100 jumps because they're new and they're maybe pushing the envelope or, the you know, do something silly. Mm-hmm. And then it's the guys with 1,000 or over. Why? They're amazing, but they get complacent.
Overconfident.
Yeah. Roger. Mm-hmm. So one of the top wingsuiters and sky surfers, a French fellow, Patrick D. Gardien, I believe is how you pronounce his name. I probably did a terrible job on his last name. Anyways, he was the leader of it years and years ago, and just an incredible skydiver. But guess what? Complacency hit. He was testing out a new system, and he sewed his pack closure like in his container. So when he went to open the reserve, because he had a malfunction, it wouldn't open up because the container was sewn together. And if I'm wrong on this, hey, someone please write me. But I'll tell you, that's the complacency. And then another big one was, and don't forget, on the aircraft, we also do gear checks with each other. But when you get up into that hierarchy of these guys that are in their thousands of jumps, some of them can be, you know, some prima donnas. And there was a big skydive competition happening somewhere in the States. This was over 10 years ago. And this fellow had been skydiving all day as a cameraman. He was following, you know, the four ways or the five ways and flying camera for these guys. So he got on the plane without a friggin' parachute. Nobody picked up, like they picked up, he didn't have a parachute. But instead of asking questions, they assumed he's just up there taking pictures on the aircraft. And he just might have been doing that, but his muscle memory kicked in. The troops exit the aircraft and he followed them out. And he is falling stable and it's all on camera. It's nice and calm. And when it came to pull height, he realized he didn't have a friggin' parachute on. Then you just see the camera moving side back and forth. So that's complacency on him, and that's complacency on the guys on the plane.
Is there ways for individuals to save someone that's falling like that? Could you
move up? Well, that's, you know, when you're flying camera and you're filming a formation, you're higher. You're above these guys. Yeah. So when they are at their time to track away, they are below, so they track away and then open up 1,000 feet later, right? Yeah. So they don't see that. Now, if you were in front of me and you had no chute on, obviously we'd be adjusting at that point, but he didn't realize until he was at pull height because no one was around him. Everyone's below him.
Oh my goodness.
Right. So, yeah. So anyways, we do lots of checks. Like when we're doing our normal skydives, we check our own kit and we check each other before we go on the aircraft. And then you go through your emergency procedures drill, which is, you know, pulling your reserve. You have two handles to pull and you go over that motion, closing your eyes. You go through the dive and then you execute doing your emergency procedures. So that's always going through your brain. Now, for doing students, we prepare their kit on the ground. So we make sure it's good. So we've done a full check on everything. Then we gear them up and then we do a jump master check again, checking all their kit. Then we walk them to the aircraft. Before we get on the aircraft, we do another jump master check. Once we're in the aircraft, before ready to dispatch a student, we do another check. So there's all that redundancy built in.
You know, I've always wanted to skydive, but terrified. And just like many beginners, you know, it's that initial step. Will I get a heart attack?
No. No. No, it's actually super enjoyable. Yeah. And of course, your first one is going to be terrifying because it's not normal to jump out of a plane. No. And then you do get comfortable. Like you asked earlier, like, are you terrified or nervous all the time? I said, yeah. So certain jumps, you're not all the time. If you've taken a bit of a break, if it's been like a month, yeah, 6 months, yeah, of course you're nervous. And so you should be. And if you're not, then maybe there's some complacency happening.
Well, I might have to come to Capital City skydiving, Capital River.
You have to. You'll love it. It's just incredible.
Do you guys do it in the winter season as well?
Yeah, we do. So it's very weather depending out here, because now we're just starting to get into the rainy season, which is better than snow. We do get some snow. It's usually for about 2 weeks, but we even jump when there's snow on the ground. But in saying that, that is for trained jumpers, because most people thinking about taking a jump course aren't really thinking about during bad weather. So we have our own net on Messenger. Mm-hmm. for all people that jump, and it's like, hey, we're going to open up this weekend, who's interested, and as long as we can get, you know, 4 or 5 loads in, we'll open up.
Wow. Were you born in BC, Tim?
I was born in Australia.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. We immigrated to Toronto when I was very young, and moved all over Canada. Mm-hmm. And the longest I ever lived in one place was Alberta when I was in the army. And we've just moved out about a year and a half out here in BC now.
Yeah. Good move. Good decision.
Oh, it's amazing. Like, all of my hobbies are out here. Yeah. And my wife and I, we just took up sailing. So we joined the Base Yacht Club. So yeah, we're sailing 35-foot yacht now. And I just competed in a sailing racing at the Warrior Games in Toronto. We competed against the Netherlands, Australia, and the U.S.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun.
You know, Tim, for the listeners, if I know you've probably talked about this in other podcasts, but kind of maybe we could talk about the journey a little bit is, you know, you said you moved around Canada. Alberta was one of the longest places you lived. How did you know you wanted to, A, get into the military? Was your dad an officer, or how did that happen?
Yeah, so my dad was Royal Navy in England. Okay. They immigrated to Australia. But he was big into war movies and things like that. So I was watching those. And then I saw paratroopers when I was 12. And I'm like, what is that? I want to do that. So from 12 years old, I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I first jumped out of a plane when I was 17 and then became a paratrooper when I was 18. So, rest is history.
Yeah. Was there ever a moment when you joined that you were regretting certain things? Like, why did I pick this career path?
Never. I love it. Addicted to it. It was definitely my thing. It was a sad day when I retired, for sure.
Oh, yeah. You've done a few missions, though, haven't you? Like, well, quite a bit.
I did Cyprus, Croatia, Afghanistan, Middle East, and Sierra Leone, West Africa.
Wow. What was it like? Jumping out of the plane, being there, you know, experiencing it all.
Oh, jumping out of planes is just amazing. Especially, you know, when you're doing it as a paratrooper. I was in the commando, you know, where you're jumping a 3-plane formation. That's 120 guys going at the same time. And we've done, you know, eight aircraft at the same time, the whole regiment going. But it's crazy when you think about it. Doing normal paratrooper static line operations. We conduct that back in the day at 800 feet. Now it's 1,000 feet. So we're jumping 800 feet, full equipment. And, you know, you got a guy right in front of you. You got a guy right behind you. And it's just go, go, go. And you're out that door. So if you think about it relative to base jumping, that's basically an 800-foot base jump with a rucksack and rifle. And all these other people. So it's nuts when you think about that alone.
And landing and your knees.
And then landing. Well, we, you know, it's 2 weeks of ground training for that. And it's just repetition, repetition, repetition of landing feet and knees together, doing a parachute landing fall. And that will keep you safe. I've landed in super high winds, uneven terrain. Mm-hmm. Long as your feet and knees together, bend at the knees, you're good. A lot of the injuries come if guys have their legs apart, even like 3 to 6 inches apart. You're going to, you know, all that weight's going on 1 foot.
Interesting. Okay.
And then with military free fall, you have a massive square canopy, just like a civilian skydiver canopy, but massive. It's like a tandem chute. It's 375 square feet. Mm-hmm. And you come in and then you flare it and it's a nice soft landing. But again, that depends on as long as you're landing into the wind, you know, on a night jump, sometimes hard to adjust for that.
And so you joined the military in 1982 and then 86, you were on the 2 Commando Airborne Regiment, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. And then how long were you in the military for?
So overall 31 years, 32 years.
Yeah.
I did 23 years full time, regular army, and the rest was reserve time. So I did 3 years in the reserves prior to joining. Mm-hmm. And then I did 5 years after the fact.
Were you married at this time?
Oh, I got married. Well, I was with my wife before I joined the army.
Yeah.
And then we got married while I was in the army. So wow. Yeah, we've been together for 38 years.
My goodness. So you were all over and yeah, she was at home and that's.
Yeah. And then my son joined and he followed footsteps airborne route in the same regiment. And now he's search and rescue.
My goodness.
In the Air Force.
Is he enjoying it? Has things changed over the years?
Boy, he's loving it. You know, it was a different ball game for him. He joined a wartime army and went to war after, you know, first year and a half in. Whereas, you know, we had a few years before we got ours.
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, he progressed through his career and then decided to go to search and rescue, which is an Air Force function, but it's all ex-Army guys that go there. It's all ex-infantry engineers and medics.
When you're going to these unknown territories or jumping off the plane, is there certain things that you kind of have to mentally prepare for in your head other than just
not really
at hand? Like
not
fear?
Really. It's your, you know, you get a good briefing on ground, what's on the ground, what the terrain's like, obstacles, things like that. You have air photos to analyze. So have a good mental picture of what you're landing into. But yeah, whenever we set up those drop zones in unproven areas, there's always that risk of, especially static line operations. You know, we jumped into Meaford, Ontario, and there was, you know, that's some heavy duty clay. And you've got vehicles that have gone through muddy areas and made these big, massive divots that are, you know, 1-2 feet right, right. deep. Once they dry, that's concrete. And you land in one of those. Yeah, those are leg breakers.
Is there something, though, in terms of, like, suppressing your emotions, your feelings, leaving it all kind of at home?
Yeah, that's the whole thing in the combat arms is suppressing emotions. That's something I'm dealing with right now. Because you do. It's mission first. And yeah, you take the emotion out of the game. Mm-hmm. I haven't cried since 2006.
Wow.
That's not a good thing. You know, your body should be able to harness all those emotions, and crying is a way of alleviating stress, right?
For sure. What was it in 06 that made you cry?
Well, we were the maneuver company on that rotation, and we covered a lot of ground, our company, C Charlie Company, 1st Battalion Patricia's. And we had 138 men in my company. At times we'd be a lot bigger when we have attachments like engineers attached, food parties and all that good stuff, forward observers. But we lost nine guys in my company were killed in action. And we had close to over 30 wounded within the company. A couple of times we had so many casualties, we couldn't even leave the gate. We didn't have the battle replacements weren't in. But anyways, in August, we're doing the whole battalion is in contact. And I was behind at the tactical operations center doing combat resupply for these guys because this was a big battalion battle. Mm-hmm. So my role with the company was to ensure I was getting them their ammo. I was doing a job called CQMS, Quartermaster Storesman, which is the next which is the job you do before you become a sergeant major. So as a sergeant major, a couple of times on mission over there when he went on leave, so that you're the understudy. And anyways, that morning, Corporal Reed was killed around 05 on the advance to the White School. So I had to go deal with that. So that was my other role, is to identify my soldiers at the morgue at Mortuary Services, which is run by the Americans on behalf of the coalition. And what they normally do is they'll come out. You don't actually have to see the body. They'll come out with a camera, digital, and say, right, is this a member? Because we want to make sure that is the correct person being sent home to the family. I couldn't identify it. So I had to go in and see it. And, you know, dead bodies of enemies, not a big deal. You paint them with that picture of evil. But your soldiers, those are the guys you love. So that was a tough one, looking at him. And he was a character. Corporal Reed was amazing, amazing man. And that's fine. Got to go through that. Wasn't the first time. And then literally I get back to the Tactical Operations Center, and we got four more killed in action from my company and plenty wounded. And so what we have is none of that stuff is broadcast on our net, even though we're all our radios are crypto. We don't say name or anything for a casualty, or what we call VSA, vital signs absent. We have a thing called ZAP numbers. So you're issued a number once you're on the ground. And so that number goes with your name. So we'll call a ZAP number out, and then you go down your manifest, and then you'll see who it actually is. So ZAP numbers came in. I'm checking my manifest, and sure enough, four more of my guys. And yeah, I just lost it. Like, we'd already had three killed in action prior to that, over the months, along with all the casualties. So that was just, and for me, it was losing those guys. It was having to stay behind. That was another issue in my head, was I wanted to be out there, but I got tasked. And that's the way it is. And you feel like, hey, maybe I could have changed the outcome. Of course I couldn't have changed the outcome, but that false thing, everybody guilt that you throw on yourself. Right. But then, I cried, and then got my shit together, and I had to go and get combat resupply. I had to get helicopters ready. I had to get all the ammo put on the helicopters. I had to get three more medics out there. And anyways.
Was this in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Okay. Gosh. And this was fighting the Taliban.
That's correct. Yeah. And like I said, we had the whole battalion was in contact that day. Like we had our battalion casualty collection point was taking harassing fire. It was crazy.
Wow.
We had support troops in an area in contact. Like, when the support troops are in contact, you know, shit's going down.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Were you the master, when you were the master sniper, are you posted up somewhere as well? No, because you're also... No,
So in Afghanistan, I wasn't the master sniper, right? I was with the rifle company. I was promoted out of that. I couldn't be an operational sniper because I was promoted out of the position.
Okay, yeah.
So then you're positioned in another area. So I did manage to... I had a sniper rifle in with me in the company. So I did manage to wrangle myself into a sniper mission, supporting company ambush. I just made that happen. we're doing this massive company ambush, and I'm like, hey, sir, I want to bring the rifle with me. He goes, I need my sergeant major on the left flank. I'm like, well, I'll be out there, but I'll have the rifle. He goes, all right, bring it along.
You're like, that's a part of me. It's coming.
Yeah. But nothing came of it. Cause our really terrible UAVs, on manned aerial vehicle. They fly so low and they're super loud that the enemy has already identified them by this time. So they're hearing that, and they realize they're under observation, so they didn't move.
Was Afghanistan the hardest mission for you, would you say? The most memorable, the toughest?
It's definitely most memorable. that was all out war. You know, quite frankly, I found Croatia harder because we're working under the UN rules. Our ROE was quite robust, actually. When we landed, the ROE had changed to if a weapon is leveled towards you, you can weapons free, you can open fire. Whereas before, you had to go through this like 10-page checklist. Has the enemy done this? Have they done that? Have you done this? Have you done that? Which is ludicrous and puts people in danger having an ROE so drastic. But you were still hands tied in ways where we called enemy forces belligerents in Croatia. And that was the hard part, is dealing with the way the belligerents moved. And also, you're in the middle of the Serbs and the Croatians. And at the same time, you have them giving you harassing fire. You know, we had Croatians blew us up, blew off guys' legs and really messed up the other fella. Yeah, we had a couple guys killed. We had a few people wounded. None of that was reported back in Canada back in 1994. Nobody knew we had a military. So that one was a tough one. And going into it was even tougher doing the training, because we had guys who'd been there before on other ROEs. And when you're training, they would constantly be going, "You're being too aggressive for this situation. You're being, you know, you have to train at this level because you can
dial
always,
it down.
You can always dial it. But if you're training here, it's going to be harder to dial it up. So train here and you can always bring it down." So that hurt us as well.
I think a lot of things in life, like train up here, do things up here and dial it down. Yeah.
Always, yeah. Always. And, you know, that's the philosophy before I left the regular army. I don't know what shape they're in now. I'm not hearing great things. But that's how we trained. After Croatia, I think things changed and we started just training at this level, which makes sense, right? Yeah. Like before we went to Afghanistan, I mean, it was not weird. We're live. All our exercises were live fire for like 3-4 years before going to Afghanistan, like ammo coming out of everywhere. And that's the only way to do it, because it makes you natural, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the casualty training, full makeup on casualties and, you know, that works so well. And role players. Actual Middle Eastern role players speaking Arabic and Pashtun. That works so well. When I prepared for my mission to Africa, all our scenario training, we hired Africans to play African parts with accents, and it gets you dialed in to go over there, because now you already know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. The pressure, the sounds, and the tonality.
Tonalities. Cultural experiences, how they deal with things, right? Like when I was in Sierra Leone, one of my I had many secondary roles, and one was paying. I was basically the regimental sergeant major of the staff college for majors and above, and we're teaching combat team attacks and all that good stuff, mission analysis. And then we had some Sierra Leone officers working with our cadre as well. And my role was to pay these guys and look after their administration as well. Quite often, these guys would come and go, hey, Sergeant Major, I need the next 2 days off. One of my kids died of malaria. So I'm like, yeah, okay. And then we're not supposed to pay them for those days, but I would pay them. But it that's the cultural side, right? At that time, I'm already desensitized from all my other missions. So I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, take 2 days off. But if you were, say, an average person with feelings, you'd be like, oh, my God, that's terrible. But you could tell those guys are the same way. It's just like, oh, it's another kid died. Because it was nonchalant. It was like, yeah, I have to, you know, bury another kid. It's like, okay, that's why they have so many. Right? Because
whoever survived,
they're all dying of malaria.
Yeah. Now, Gunny, you met the Prince of Wales, right? The King of...
Yeah.
King Charles.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. So when we were in Cyprus, with the Airborne Regiment was deployed to Cyprus, And I'm a brand new trooper. That's rank of private in the airborne. And the parachute regiment, which is the British equivalent, they were over there at the same time. So what he did, he is an actual paratrooper and he's colonel of the paras. He came over to sign the paperwork to make three para our sister regiment. So I was very lucky and I was selected just by, luckily I wasn't on shift, I wasn't on duty, and got to go and meet him. And so they had a representation of all the ranks from paras, representation from us. And we got together, had tea and biscuits, and got to chat with, at the time, Prince Charles. Very nice guy. I mean, he's good at meet and greet. That's their job. And it was just nice. You got to actually have a chat with him.
Did he say anything? Did he give you some wisdom or inspiration?
Well, I'm pretty sure he did. I don't remember it to this day. But I just remember that he was a pleasant fellow. It was a great experience.
Isn't that funny, though, at times, you know, wherever you go, it's not what that person said, but it's how they made you feel.
Yes.
You'll always remember that.
Yes. Exactly. Because, you know, you can meet a really great guy who's having a crap day, and then after you've met them, you go like, wow, that guy was kind of a dick. But then you find out, oh, he had a bad day. But no, he was dialed in that day, and it was great, great exposure.
You were so desensitized after so many missions and all these things and being surrounded by that culture. And now you're starting to peel back the onion. Do you feel like it's necessary for you to do so? Or do you feel like, no, I'm good being tough and strong and I don't need to crack?
No, you need to crack because, I got pretty bad PTSD. Mm-hmm. And it took getting out of both jobs, the military, and then I went straight into policing, doing executive protection. And when you're putting your suit on, like executive protection, I'm not wearing a hard uniform, I'm wearing a suit with my body armor, my weapons, and all that good stuff. As soon as you throw that on, game face is on, no emotion, because we don't speak, we don't talk, we don't smile. And you get to put all those feelings back in the locker again. So the cycle continues. I finally broke down in 2013 and just lost my shit. And I had to take about 8 months off. Particular premier I worked with was so ludicrous. She pushed me over the edge. And thankfully, because it worked out for the best. If I didn't have that person to protect, that maybe I wouldn't have got the help I needed. And in saying that, that's just still ongoing, right? You don't correct that in, oh, hey, that's an 8 month exposure, you're good to go. No, you just be able to, you're just managing yourself better, right? You're still functional at that point because I find when I'm meeting people who are really ramped in their PTSD, they hide it through working. And that's what I did. My operational tempo in the Army was just ridiculous. The last 10 years in the military, we're just constantly on mission. And when you're not on a mission, then you're training for mission, or you're training the next troops, for mission, then you're training for mission, and then you deploy. So in executive protection, it was the same thing. We're working 8 days on, six off. And on those 8 days, you're working 16 to 18 hour days, sometimes one meal a day. So there is no time. It's just constant mission planning and mission execution. And you are not sleeping well. You are overworked, underfed. So it's just mission, right? So you don't get to think and consolidate your emotions at all.
Was your brain power and energy at that 80 to 100% at all times? Because you could not dial back.
Yeah. When you're on mission, you're just on. And when you come off that 8 day shift, you're on your six off, your first 2 days is administration, getting your suits into the dry cleaners, washing all your laundry, repacking your suitcases. Because you go on that 8 days, you don't know where you're going to go. Your schedule, long range schedule looks like, hey, we're in Edmonton or Calgary all week. And then the next day you're deploying to New York. It's like, oh, hey, you got to fly advanced to New York tonight. So you always have that go bag packed, ready to go. So now that I've retired from that,
Do you use skydiving now and being an instructor as a distraction, though?
Big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So such a good point. Skydiving gives me my military feel back. Mm-hmm. Our drop zone is the only military-owned drop zone in Canada. So we have a lot of ex-military jumping there as well. And all the civilians that jump there, they're just like a bunch of army guys, because it's just that different mentality of people that get involved in skydiving as well. So it's like a really tight family. If anyone has any issues, we're there to help. And the parties are definitely like infantry parties. You know, it's crazy. It's such a good group of people. But yeah, that's definitely my replacement, which is good because it's controlled and it's at my choosing. Like, I just go there to jump and I'll teach a couple of courses. That's my only connection to the drop zone. I'm not an owner. I'm just a dude. So I can go, you know what? I'm not feeling it this weekend. I'm not going.
So it's a healthy distraction and it's something that can take you back to something you enjoyed, but it's not deteriorating you. And
yeah. No, it's positive, right? It gives me, because that is one thing you lack when you leave, is you miss that brotherhood. You miss all the really cool stuff you did, all the exciting stuff you did. And parachuting, you know, that's been with me before I joined. I love everything to do with it. The smell of the harness, the parachute, the smell of the fuel, the sound, the noise, the wind, everything about parachuting. So it just gets you into a nice, happy place. And now that we kayak a lot, but now we ratcheted that up and now we're sailing. And sailing's like a very mellow skydiving. You're dealing with wind and you're dealing with, you got to plan that sail. And it's very exciting. It's fun. You're dealing with the elements. So yeah, now I got another sport I'm addicted to. And talking about, calling it a sport. It is, but it's like calling curling a sport. Is it? You know, is darts? No. But I had my first exposure to sail racing with the Veterans Organization. True Patriot Love ran this sailing event, Warrior Sailing. And I have to thank them. They're amazing. They paid for everything to get me out there. And they paid for the Australian team to come. Just amazing group. But funny story of the sailing. Sailing isn't very fast. And yet your adrenaline is flowing, especially before the start line. And you have to like track back and forth before you can cross that line. And it's counting down from 5 minutes and you can't reach that line or else you're penalized. And then fighting to get jockey into position before that alarm goes off. And then you're going up. And then when you're coming downwind, you're going super slow.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just agonizing. So it's the most excitement you can have going super slow is when you're doing your downwind leg. But when you're tacking upwind, it is incredible.
Oh, it's
and
fun.
The tactics you can use, because you can tack at any time on how you get to that next roundabout point. And the key is to get to that roundabout point and then get yourself onto a starboard tack. And then you have right away, and then you can screw the other guys that are trying to make their turn onto that, because you're already in starboard tack, so they have to maneuver around you.
Exactly. And do you know all the knots?
Oh, yeah. Like in the reconnaissance platoon, you have to know all your knots. So going into the knot work was super easy. So I was teaching my wife, actually.
It's definitely a benefit to have.
Yeah. So before we even went on course, she had all her knots down.
I love it. It helps, eh, to know those things and when you need to use them. And
oh, exactly. Like there's millions of different style knots. Knots have purposes and reason. And, you know, there's a core of a good 12 set of knots that you really only need to use that will complete all the functions you require.
How did you get into sailing, though?
Well, just moving out of the coast. So we started kayaking 12 years ago. And, you know, living in Alberta, we're doing all the lakes. We'd come out here and do some trips and do, like, you know, live 7 days out of our kayaks. Mm-hmm. And then when we got here, it's like, I want to learn to sail. We live right on the ocean. Like I'm a 10-minute walk to the ocean, right to our marina. So let's do this. And it's incredible. And we belong to the base yacht club. So as a veteran, you are the same status as a serving member. Nice. And we have three yachts in the base club. And it's only $100 a day to rent a 35 footer.
My goodness.
Yeah, why not?
Well, exactly. When you look at that transition from Army to being a part of the Alberta Sheriff's Branch, what was that like, that shift?
Well, obviously, it was nervous. It's, you know, leaving the Army sucks. You know, I did make that decision, but that's a massive part of your life because it's not a job. It's a lifestyle, everything about it. Then I'm going into another government service, hoping that I, you know, this better not be hokey. I better live up to my expectations. You know, I trained the Edmonton Police ERT team. I trained their snipers for a few years. And then they gave me their advanced urban police sniper course, which was really good. But so I already had a basis of what I might expect. The sheriffs, Alberta sheriffs, aren't like the other sheriffs around Canada. Yeah, the bread and butter is prisoner transport all across Canada within the province and then court security detail. But we are more set up like a provincial service. So even though they are peace officers, only depending on what unit you move to, your peace or your authorities are more. So for instance, in executive protection, my authority was all over Canada. I was a peace officer in every province and we flew everywhere armed all over Canada.
So you could fly with a firearm?
Yeah.
At all times?
Yep. Oh. Yeah, it's easy. You just fill out the paperwork. Mm-hmm. Obviously for badge members only, right? Anyways, the training was amazing. So we started our recruit training. Yeah, instructors were incredible. The scenarios were great. Lots of fighting, defensive tactics. It is all out fighting. You're doing two-on-ones, one-on-ones, three-on-ones, getting pepper sprayed, you know, and fighting through that. And the defensive driving, it's the same, everything's the same package as the as the different police services within Alberta get. Our shooting package is the exact same. Our driving package is the same. As a matter of fact, we send staff to their courses. They send staff to our courses. So okay. It's all works together. And, you know, we work together. So with the sheriffs, we have the, obviously the bread and butter prisoner security. Then we have our surveillance unit. They are all undercover and they do go up to federal level investigations. We have our highway patrol with cars, motorcycles. They use BMWs and Harley Davidson. We also have our counter terrorism unit, which is not operators, but they're analysts. So they obviously work with all key infrastructure within the province itself. As you can appreciate, Alberta is the third largest oil producer in the world. So yes, we have a lot of targets. And that's why, you know, we have security for our premier, because not all premiers have security.
Interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. So what are they a threat from in terms of climate activists? Is it
everything? You name it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Climate activists, which we know through intel is most of them are, it's all funded by other oil countries who just want to suppress our oil industry. And the,
well, and then we get our,
and then those people that are protesting, they're actually, you know, thinking they're being good people and protesting a cause, but not realizing they're actually, it's being pushed by Saudi Oil or another organization, right? So all those poor people that are actually doing it and getting arrested are puppets for these big money guys that are just trying to take our industry out and keep theirs alive.
Oh my God. There was something I saw recently and I oil paint just for something, just to calm myself down. I paint.
Yeah.
And so I saw I think it was Vincent van Gogh and another famous artist at a museum.
Oh, yes.
Tomato paste thrown at it. And because it was made with oils, which was fossil fuels.
Yeah. So these people don't understand, right? Everything they wear, clothes, food,
tires,
everything is made from petroleum. You take that away, you have nothing. But it's just funny when, but for long lines of exec protection, it's funny to talk about the protesters. So I worked for the NDP, right? And we know who they are. And I work with all the conservative governments. So it's funny when you're working with a conservative government, you have all the NDP type people, the left-wing people, are nasty, nasty protesters. They are throwing stuff at you, yelling obscenities. They are violent. And they're the ones that call the other side violent. And then when, after we finished 4 years with the NDP, And then we're with our first NDP government, and we're leaving this event, and then all the conservative protesters were outside. It was comical. It's like they were all nice. They're just holding signs, and they got coffee, they got donuts, and they see the premier. They're like, "Hey, premier, have a good day." Hmm. And they're, you know, like night and day, but their protesters throw stuff at you and call you names, and the conservative protests are just like, "Hey, everybody, have a good day." I'm like, wow, this is like, I had a grin on my face. Like, this is crazy. So yeah, the conservative protesters were like super nice. And the other guys were just evil.
So you protected 5 premiers of Alberta. I'm in Calgary. So,
oh, awesome. Yeah. So we were in the McDougal Center quite a bit.
Yes. And so would you be one of the sheriffs also walking around the McDougal Center?
No.
No.
No. Okay. No, no. I wasn't uniformed. I was with the executive protection. So we're in suit.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you never have to switch and do different duties? No. Okay. Interesting.
No. But once you're in that, certain unit, that's what you do.
Okay. How many? So 5 premiers. Who were they? That was
Alison. Yeah, started off with Alison Redford. Then we had Hancock as interim.
Oh yes,
yeah. Very good guy, hard worker, super nice man. Mm-hmm. And then Prentice came in, and then he lost, and then Notley came in, and then we had Notley for 4 years. After Notley, then we went into Jason Kenney.
Yeah, Premier Kenney, yeah. And now we have...
an incredible guy. That guy is... He got such a bad rap. Well, because of COVID, right? Mm-hmm. But talk about a guy who... energy, hardworking, gentleman, just pleasant guy and cares.
Premier, would you say, or what term was the toughest for you to deal with?
Redford. Alison Redford.
Interesting.
She was ridiculous.
Was it just demands as a premier, or was
no, she was ridiculous. I can't really go into detail, but she was outrageous. Outrageous. It was so bad that the cleaners wouldn't even come into the premier's wing to clean if they knew she was in the house. When she was fired, no one smiled for the 2.5 years she was there. When she got fired, everybody was smiling in that building.
So it's a toxic culture.
Massive.
Yeah, that's not fun. And that's probably hard for you at times. Well, it is your job.
Big time. Because she...
You're protecting this person. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I'm with her every bloody day. Mm-hmm. And I was one of her favorites, so I was always with her. So I was never on the Vance team. Very rarely would I get an advance gig, so you get a break. I'm with her all the time. But that did work out in my benefit at the end of the day, because I was seconded to the unit originally, and then at the end of the election, they sent me back to patrol, and because the position number then went to the Calgary team instead of the Edmonton team. So the next day she saw me in my hard uniform. She's like, "What are you doing there?" I'm like, "This is my job." And literally 10 minutes later, I get a phone call. It's like, "Yeah, go change. You're in the team." So she called the chief and went, "I want this guy." So that worked out for me, really. But she was difficult.
I was at the Blues Can in Inglewood when Notley.
Oh my God. Don't get me started on that. I've trapped in that place so many bloody times.
Oh, really?
With Notley.
Yeah. Oh, she likes that place or
Oh my
something?
God. Any time we're in Calgary, we're there.
Oh, okay. Because I had gone there.
Because that's Joe Cece's area.
Interesting. Oh, yes, it
Right?
is.
He
Yeah, I
lives in
knew
that
both.
area. So
Okay.
they're good buddies, good running buddies.
That's why she was there. Yeah, so you see the Suburban, there's a guy sitting behind me. And yeah, it was just interesting. And they're suited up.
I might have been the guy you probably saw
That's what I
because
was thinking.
I was
I
already
have to
there.
look at my pictures
Good
again.
looking, short, stocky guy. That's me.
Yeah.
But no, I have to say though, in fairness, I mean, obviously I'm a conservative, but I spent 4 years with Premier Notley, and she was amazing to work for. She was a good person. I just don't agree with her politics, and but she was a great work atmosphere, and she was great.
It's good though. You
But
got to pay respect to both sides
you
and
do, and I mean that's the army as well. Like the army, doesn't matter what federal government's in play, you're on doing whatever agenda is being moved. But no, Notley was great. She was proud of the team. She loved us. She crashed our Christmas parties. She's just a pleasant lady. Great to work for.
it's good that you're able to
But
separate the art and the artist almost.
yeah, it is. And same thing with her. She has that ability as well. Not everybody in the NDP's crazy. There was a couple of good NDP people in her team as well. Like, I mean, in positions that are fine, good people, but their politics are opposite of what we think. So it's all good. I mean, it's that's part of the job, right?
Exactly. Do you have a couple more minutes here, Tim?
Sure.
Yeah. When we look at that breakdown you had, was that in 2013 and you took 8 months off, give or take? Was that due to PTSD as well, or was that just
Yeah.
pressure and cracking?
No, that was my PTSD that's been bottled up for all those years since 94, man. And it just came out crashing. And you know what? And in saying that is about average. Usually, most people, if they have PTSD, what I've noted, I'm not a doctor, but from observing my soldiers and observing other people, after an extreme exposure to something over, like for me, it was extreme exposure over a long time. I find most people, it really starts culminating anywhere from 10 to 15 years after the fact, it starts to really come out. And that's when people start crashing. And as I said, a lot of the indicators, it was for me and most of the guys that were in my line of work. A big indicator that you're ready for a crash is where you're just constantly working and you're never taking a break. Like, I'm working 18-hour days with executive protection, and then I only have 6 days off. But in those 6 days off, I'm volunteering for all sorts of crazy stuff. Like, oh, I'll do this and I'll do that. And it's like, right? And you're just constantly going, and you're never taking that break. It's a wild ride, and it's one I don't think you fully get over PTSD, because what it actually does, it changes your physiology. And how is that? Well, I have high blood pressure. I don't smoke. I work out every day. I don't eat bad. I drink maybe once or twice a month.
I see
Right?
what you're saying.
But that, especially when you're operating overseas, you're ramped up, you're into that, you're in that operational mode, right? You're on. So your body is, all that physiology is changing. So I was surprised when I got that diagnosis, and that'll never go away. Because once you get ramped up into that level, it will never, doesn't matter how much exercise, how much diet, it will stay in that. So I have to take drugs every day.
Is the PTSD a reflection of, fallen soldiers understanding life as you've seen it? Because, us as civilians haven't seen at a fraction of anything. Maybe the
Well,
movies? Yeah.
you're getting these exposures, when you're deployed, quite a lot. So just imagine a paramedic, police officer that's seeing this stuff every day, especially police officers and firefighters, medics seeing motor vehicle accidents every day, right? But it's kind of a different carnage because you're seeing it after the fact. Yeah, you get desensitized to the bodies. What is the thing that is different than, say, a deployment? Well, on the deployment, you're seeing your guys hit. You're seeing that all those close calls on you, right? And so you get that feeling of, I'm next. This is the next one's for me. So you're constantly in that fear zone. You control the fear, obviously, through training. But still, that human factor is like, holy shit, that was close. Yeah. Like fuck. You know? Yeah. So that definitely is a different feeling to your brain, to your body, than, say, showing up in a motor vehicle accident, because there was no harm to you. You're seeing the harm. Yeah, seeing that stuff over years is going to hurt, obviously. But the true post-traumatic disorder is, as Colonel Grossman says, it's human-on-human contact. So, like, his analogy is, if you broke your leg skiing or skydiving, you'd be like, yeah, man, broke this skydiving, so cool, woo, it's on my leg. But if I came and I saw you in the middle of the street and I just came, didn't know who you were, and I just came up to you from behind and broke your femur with a baseball bat, you're going to have PTSD because you're like, why did that happen to me? And is it going to happen again? Right? But yeah, so it comes in all forms. And again, you can seek help. You should seek help. Again, though, but your body might not, or your brain might not accept it at that time, because you're going to be ramped and you might be operating still. But you do need to see help. Is it going to cure you? No, but it's going to manage you, just like physiotherapy, right? You got a screwed up leg or arm and you go to physio. And then after physio is done, what do? You don't just don't do anything. You continue exercising. Mm-hmm. You continue
the working. Stretches and yeah.
Yeah. You continue working that issue out. So it's the same thing with PTSD. Yes. Oh my God. When I had that breakdown and I went and saw help. Mm-hmm. Wow. It was emotional. It was crazy. My doctor, she is incredible. She's a stud. She only sees police and army guys and that's it. Right. So I don't want to minimize other people's issues, but you know, the guy before you wasn't like, my mom and dad hate me. It's like, yeah, get over it. Right. Yes. So she's dealing with all these guys who've been there. And she was a peace officer at one time herself. So she's been on that side of defensive tactics and all that good stuff. And she's also a negotiator for the Edmonton police, whenever they call. Anyways, she was using this thing called MDR. I wish I could remember the acronym to it, but it's rapid eye movement. And so they have you looking at the, like, follow this, and then they're doing all sorts of weird things. And, you know, originally I would be old Gunny would be like, that's hokey. I'm not into it, but it worked. And cause you have to give into it. You have to believe. And oh my God, it was emotional. It was brutal. Like it worked though. And then, after a few months of doing the MDR, then she would do that on me again. I'm like, okay, I can't get into this, because I feel like she got all that stuff out.
Okay.
Yeah. But the deep stuff. But then other times she's like, okay, do all this. And in my head, I'm just like, oh, I'm just going to go through the motions here. Like, okay, where are you feeling now? But you know, 10 being bad or 10 being good. I'm like, 7, I'm good. She goes, oh, okay, let's keep working. And in my head, I'm like, oh my God, look, I don't need this. Let's just keep talking now. So the MDR worked for getting that deep stuff for me. So yeah, so every week I still have an hour with that was Kelly Furman. She's amazing in Edmonton, sorry. And now I'm with this other lady that I work with from Alberta. We just do our Zoom meetings once a week. And it's great, because a lot of it is just having a chat. Right. Great. And she's like a detective. So she's like, how's it going? And blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, fuck, I'm feeling good. Just and they're just chatting. And then she's just gathering that information. And she goes, okay, so let's talk about that. I'm like, oh, you're good. Like, and I just thought, you know, just telling her about my week. Yeah. So it's interesting stuff. And plus, it's the other layers is your family. Like my wife's amazing, and she's good. She's really good at getting stuff out. And and then from my experience, I like to then try and coach and give advice to my guys, which I've always have. I always looked after my guys, but I never looked after myself. I would be the first one to go see help, but I wouldn't go see help. It's easier to push it than to do it, right?
Always.
And before I left the army, my wife's like, "You got to go see help, man." Like I'm like, "Oh, it's just gonna be hokey. They're gonna go, hey, how's that make you feel? Blah blah blah. I don't want to do it." So sure enough, I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna suck it up for my wife. I'm gonna go see help. So I go to the base, psychiatrist. And I lost my shit and I left and I went, fuck this. And what had happened was exactly what was in my head. I get in there. First of all, he was like a Middle Eastern man. I'm just straight out of the goddamn desert, man. And that set me off. So I'm already in a defensive posture, in mentally speaking. But I'm like, all right, keep your shit together. Get through this. It's for the woman. I'm going to do this. So then we start talking, and he goes, so how does that make you feel? And I just went, fuck this, I'm out. Because that's what I said to my wife. I'm like, all they're going to do is say, so how does that make you feel? I think that's the worst thing you can say to people.
I agree.
And I'm not trained. But anyways, I think, through that, I hate the word journey. It drives me nuts. Such a left-wing thing. Like, how's your journey? Anyways, through my experience, I look back and it's funny because you got to laugh at this stuff, right? And you got to laugh at yourself. And that's one good thing my wife and my daughter are good at is making fun of me and making me laugh. So,
You can't take life too seriously.
no, not at all. Like, laugh about it, man. Like, we laugh about ridiculous things I do and some silly things I do. Because it is PTSD that's making me do silly things, and then they just have to remind me, okay, that was ridiculous. I'm like, oh yeah, you're right. And then we have a good laugh. And then we can relook at that in the future. Oh, remember that time you did? Yeah, that was funny.
Do you
But
feel at
you got to
peace
do
or
that.
do you feel contentment now that you're going to therapy or in
Oh, absolutely.
medication?
I feel so way more relaxed. I still have, hey, don't get me wrong. I still have these issues of avoidance. So, hey, guy, you want to do coffee tomorrow? Yeah, let's do coffee tomorrow. The next day I'll phone and go, hey, sorry, man, I can't make it. I got something came up. Nothing came up. It's just I couldn't get myself to get out of the house. And it's the same thing with my skydiving. That's my happy place. But some, like, I'm like excited to get out of the drop zone. And it's like, I'm not going. I can't go. Well, why? I do it, leave the house. So, this good guy out there named, hello, Sean Taylor. He helps me a lot because he's my accountability and my family's my accountability. But what's my accountability if I'll volunteer to teach a course at the drop zone? So that's my accountability. I have to be there to start that course at 9 o'clock. So I need to be there for 8:30 to set up. So that's my accountability. But if I was just going to go, hey, want to go skydive on the weekend? And I'll pull out. So I still need those checks and balances. I need that bit of accountability,
You know,
right?
it's crazy though, because
And
it's crazy because
yeah,
you
carry
think
on.
about it, your life used to be so every minute, every second counted, millisecond
Regimented.
counted. And all of a sudden, it's a total opposite where, like you said, you'll make that promise, but you're not gonna, or you might in that moment think you're gonna show up the next day. Do you? Like you're not doing it on purpose. No.
No, not at all. And my buddy Sean Taylor, you interviewed him. He's my accountability as well. He was a guy I looked up to in Two Commando. He was only what a year older than me, but to me, like I got there, he was already there. To me, he's this god. And I want to, because you always pick positive people to be your role model, right? And your role model can be a guy of the same rank. He could be someone even lower than you. He could be
Doesn't matter.
higher. Doesn't have to be full up here. And, you look at these guys when you get there and you go, oh my God, that guy's stud. I want to be like that dude. And I want to be like that guy. And I want to be, and so you take all those little bits and pieces, right? And yeah, so now that we've reconnected, and we do social media pretty heavy. I like to use him as my accountability as well. So if he says something or tasks me with something or suggests something, I go on it. I do it.
What
Because
is it about Sean, though, that, since, like you said, back then he was that guy and he's still that guy? What is
yeah,
it about
he's
that
just,
individual? Yeah.
well, I mean, he's your, he was one of the original Tier One. And that's the kind of guys that Tier One has, right? These guys are absolute amazing people, good at everything they do, and lead by example. So that's what it is about him. Like everything he does is righteous and good. And I mean, look at him today. He's still a world-class coach, and he's developed his sons to be these amazing young men that came out and jumped. I had the pleasure to train both his sons and him to jump out of a plane and dispatch them. And, one's a jujitsu guy. The other guy's written a book already. It's like, that's the kind of leadership he's doing. And his wife is this long distance runner. Like she'll just go run for 8 hours. So positive guy. And I'm glad he's on social media now. He's giving a good positive message out there to other veterans. It's good for everybody, good for the community. And him and Seb Lavoie, I don't know if you've interviewed
I
him
did,
yet. He's
yes.
amazing.
Great guy, yeah.
Yeah. And those two have got together and have written a book. So I'm super excited for that to be published. And I think their words of wisdom will be good for Canada. And I wish them all the luck for that book.
Absolutely. When you look at the World War II veterans, they didn't use social media. There wasn't social media. A lot of people take those stories and that emotion to the grave. Or I've seen things where, or sorry, I've heard stories where individuals will, abuse substances such as alcohol and drugs, and then, their family life suffers, right?
Well, what was the social media of the World War One, World War Two vets, Korea vets, the Legion,
The Legion.
right?
Yes.
And they would all go to Legion. So yeah, you're going to Legion, and back in the day, the alcohol was massive. Everybody was a drunk, and so the PTSD was strong. I mean, you look at not everyone did it, obviously, but majority, a lot of domestic abuse in those days. A lot of abuse to the kids. And that came out through, that was their PTSD lashing out because they didn't have anyone to talk to. They didn't have social media. And that's why social media is so important, especially in the veteran community. Like Facebook, when that came out, I was on it and that was a way for me to still talk to all my troops, right?
Keep in touch, yeah.
And stay in touch and you can post events. Hey, we're going to do a barbecue here. Or, picnic or gathering at this restaurant. So it's a good way to keep people connected. And that is the new Legion for our generation. And well, I'm approaching 60. I'm 58 now. So I mean you can call me the old dog, but back in my 30s, we wouldn't go to the Legion because everyone's too old. And now the Legion's lost its way. Now the Legion is 90% civilians,
Yes.
right? And as a matter of fact, I've gone to many a Legion, so it's not just one or two. And you go in there in uniform and they look at you with disdain. Like, what are you doing in the Legion? It's like, well, I'm in the army. What are you doing in the Legion? And they're,
So
and
true.
Legion have these fake medals they issue themselves, right? That they wear on the opposite, like we wear our medals on the left side, so those are not approved medals in the from the Governor General, so they're worn on the right side. So your average civilian, like my son, when he came home from Afghanistan at 21 years old, they don't think this 21-year-old kid is a combat veteran. But they see some civilian guy who's in his late 60s with these Legion medals on, and they're like, oh, that guy must be a veteran. It's like, no, he's not. So these guys have lost the plot. And yeah, the Legions are hurting. The Legions do a lot of good work, don't get me wrong. They do fundraisers and all that. They're good for the communities, but that's why we have Lions Clubs and the Elks and you know, all these other good institutions that bring money and funding into sports. But the Legion does do good they do advocate for veterans still, which is good. But I think the Legion needs to really take a look. Like, if they're losing membership, they're losing money, they need to revamp
and, the model. Yeah.
Big time. It's got to be a model for today.
And would that be more social media, more, maybe even a podcast?
More social media, yeah. Maybe a great idea. Podcast of new veterans. And also, don't forget, a veteran isn't someone who's been to war. A veteran is, as soon as you've signed that line and you do your contract, you're a veteran. You don't have to be deployed to be a veteran. You are a veteran because you joined the service.
And it's not about X amount of years?
No. You serve your initial contract, you're a veteran.
Yeah, see, I would have never known that.
See, that's where people get lost, right? I remember when those World War II guys came back, they're 24 years old, young veterans. And just like my troops from Afghanistan that were in their 20s when they came home. But the average civilian looks at that 20-year-old and goes, that guy's not a veteran, combat veteran. Yeah, he is. But again, remember, anyone who signs that line is a veteran. And I want military people. There's guys in the military that go, well, I'm not a veteran because I didn't go overseas. Like, I hate that attitude. No, you are. It's like when I meet guys who've done the military jump course, basic parachutist course, we have two sets of wings. You have the red maple leaf and a white maple leaf. Red maple leaf means you've done the course. The white maple leaf means you've served in an airborne role for at least 2 years in an operational unit. So when I meet guys who have their basic para and they never went to an airborne unit, and I ask them, oh, you jumper? They're like, yeah, I just did the course. Well, you're a paratrooper. You jumped out of a plane. You did the same course I did, but you just didn't serve in an airborne unit. Like, we have this thing in the Canadian Forces where we downplay people's accomplishments, and it drives me insane. We don't celebrate these big accomplishments well enough, and we have to get better at it. You did the basic parachutist military course. Holy shit. Well done.
I think celebrating the first step as well, you know, I've decided to join the military.
Yeah. Right from the beginning. Yeah. Or when you meet guys going, well, I was just a truck driver. I was just like, oh my God, you were a truck driver in the army. Like, that's crazy. You're shooting rifles and machine guns and you're doing crazy ass shit. Not just driving a truck or a cook. Have you seen how hard the military cooks work when they're in the field? They work hard enough in garrison. In the field, those guys are doing prepping meals for, you know, a rifle company, 140 guys. And they're prepping those meals in the field when it's raining, it's snowing. And prepping all that food. It's just constant, constant work. Yeah, it's not out there running section attacks and company attacks and doing all that stuff, but they're
fueling the ammunition.
Miserable, unthankable job. And my hat's off to all those guys, man. And, you know, when I was teaching at the battle school, I'd always make sure I get my cooks and all my support staff. And I'm like, you're coming to the range and you're going to be putting some rounds downrange on the sniper rifle. Because everyone's part of the team. Yeah, great. Yeah, cool. I'm, you know, recce reconnaissance guy and free fall and sniper. Got to do all that cool shit. Yeah, it was a lot of hard work to get there. But I didn't get there without my cook. I didn't get out there without my clerk. All those people made it achievable for me to do those things. That's why we're a team. We're not individuals in the military. We're a team. Everybody counts. Yeah.
You know, you talk about this PTSD. Before we get going here, Tim, we talk about PTSD. Your son's in the military. What are some things that you tell him to be careful about or weary of? Or do you avoid saying that so he can go through his own journey?
Well, it's different because he grew up with me.
and knew all my peers. He knew my troops, right? So when he was 14, I'd have like my troops over her in their 20s. And so he's talking to them. They listen to the same music. They shoot the shit. And then when he joined the army, now he's peers with them. So he already knows these guys. So for him, it was a different world. Like he already knew, he knew what was going on. And likewise, he went into my regiment. Right. So, yeah, I mean, all his leadership were my buddies, right? They were peers of mine. So they already knew. And Nick has probably met these guys before. So, yeah, there was no real advice. I mean, he went right into the fire. A year and a half later, he's in Afghanistan.
Is that scary for you now as being a dad and that's a son out there?
Yeah, that was crazy. I was supposed to be on the same mission. And, yeah, I wouldn't be in the same company. But then my wife is like, you're not going at the same time. So, yeah, it was a basket case. So I realized all those years what my wife went through.
If there's somebody struggling with PTSD, Tim, what is something you can leave with them? You know, a vet of any sort, you know, police,
yeah,
first responders, military.
First of all, don't look at PTSD as it's a bad thing. It's not. It's not a bad thing. It's the side effect to the job you do that you love, right? If you twist your ankle running because of your job, you have to stay fit. Well, that's the side effect to that job. Or you get injured in a fight, doing defensive tactics, taking someone down, or whatever you're doing, hurt your leg jumping. You wear that with pride. And it sounds silly to say you can wear PTSD with pride. You don't, but it's the side effect. So what do we do? Well, we go get our ankle looked at. We go get our shoulder looked at. So go get your brain looked at, because your brain drives everything. Right? So yeah, go see help and don't think of it as a bad thing. Don't think it's not weak. It's weak if you don't get help. It takes strength to get help and it's got to be done. Got to do it. And right now there is no bloody excuse to not seek help. We have so many goddamn veterans online and advocators that you can see and listen to, videos you can listen to. There are so many American veterans chatting and talking on podcasts, Canadian ones. Like, get on these things, listen to them, and see everyone's story is basically the same. And it doesn't matter what country you're from. Everyone has the same. It's just the human factor. So go see help. Do it. And don't delay. The more you put it off, the worse it gets. Because, as I said earlier, it changed the physiology in my body, which gave me high blood pressure, which is then in turn, I'm a fit guy, but it's still going to reduce my life. Right? I'm not going to live as old as I should have lived, because eventually this high blood pressure is going to do me in.
And is there a way to reduce it though? Your high blood pressure now?
No. As I said, my doctor described it. It got ramped, and it was ramped for so long that it will never come down. So again, I work out every day and I've never smoked in my life. And, you know, I got fat civilian friends who are obese, who smoke and drink every day, and they don't have high blood pressure, but they're going to die early from a heart attack. But for me, so unfortunately I have to be on medication for the rest of my life.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Tim. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for the offer to come on the podcast.
Yes.
And out of Calgary, which is a great city, so very jealous. I spent every summer there with the premier, going to with the various premiers doing the rodeo, so very familiar.
The good old Stampede, yeah.
And I was posted there when the battalion was in Calgary.